This is Unleashing Your Great Work, a podcast about doing the work that matters the most to you. I'm Dr. Amanda Kroll, a cognitive psychologist and the author of the book, Great Work. Every week on this podcast, we make bold plans and we take small steps, all so we can build a life that's powered by your great work. Welcome, everybody, to Unleashing Your Great Work. Today, we have Dr. Catherine Franzen, who is passionate about teaching high achievers how to use practical strategies backed by science to improve productivity, performance, and well-being. She's received her PhD in neurobiology from the University of Chicago and has thrived at multiple universities over the past two decades. Her collaborative research over the past two decades has appeared in prestigious academic journals as well as popular media outlets. Her areas of expertise include stress management, mental health, and neurodiversity. Welcome to the podcast, Catherine.
Thank you. Hi, Amanda. I'm so glad to be here.
Yes, I have very much been looking forward to this conversation for a couple of reasons. One, we have some things in common, both sort of PhDs in sort of the same space, but your space is the actual science of it, and mine is all about application, but you're sort of a scientist who thinks about application. And I'm sort of an applied person who thinks about the science. So I feel like this is going to be such a good, like, synergistic meeting of the minds.
Yes, yes, exactly. Me too. I'm excited for the same reason.
Yay. All right. So Catherine, we're going to start where we always do and ask you to tell us a little bit about your great work.
I've been thinking about this question because it's such an amazing question. And I have really enjoyed listening to your podcast and reading your book and just learning about what you mean by great work. And it's really challenged me to think about that and in a new way. So I think of my great work as sort of preventative mental health education. So many people are walking around and they tell me I'm stressed out. I'm so overwhelmed. I'm so stressed. And I wish that we had a better way of educating people on lifestyle choices and decisions they can make so that they can manage their stress and mental health on a regular, everyday, preventative kind of way, the way that we brush our teeth or schedule our regular checkups or something like that, so that we don't get to crisis mode when it comes to being stressed out or overburdened, and we only seek help with our mental health once it gets into an absolute crisis moment. So to me, it's all about using what I've learned as a neuroscientist and to create practical strategies to help people on a daily basis.
Wow. You know, that's so interesting that I had not heard it described like that by anyone else. And what I like about it is that I've been trying to talk about that. I had a whole podcast series two Christmases ago called the Resilience Series. And I was trying so much less successfully than you just did to try to make the case that resilience needs to be a practice, that we watch it the same way we watch our bank account, that we have to think about, like, have we lost our capability of bouncing back? And even like burnout, I feel like, is just part of that cycle too. That's where I sort of started thinking about it. But I love the idea of it being more broadly applicable to mental health too. What great work, actually. So is it something that, like, how did you come to this as your, I mean, if you were a, I know what it's like to be a bench scientist a little bit, like, it's not, application is not really where most of the people in our field spend their time. So how did you come to this area of passion and interest?
Well, I think it starts from, you know, being a little kid who always asked the question, why? I was that annoying kid who annoyed her parents so much that we got a new, you know, set of encyclopedias. But I became fascinated with human behavior and trying to understand what are the things that make people behave differently and react differently. And I majored in psychology, and then in college, I became fascinated with, you know, wait a minute. All right, so the thing that makes one person react differently from another is maybe distilled down to little molecules and chemicals in their brain, and that is so fascinating. So I went on to get my degree in neurobiology, and I, you know, continued pursuing that. But what I really cared about was sort of the application of those molecules and chemicals to the behavior of the whole organism and coming back out. So across the last 20 years, sort of thinking about a lot of the different research that I've done, is taking some of what I had learned about hormones and neurochemistry and bringing that back out to studying how humans are behaving and what are the hormones that might be underlying that. And then how could we maybe change behaviors that then would then change the chemistry? A lot of people think about like their biology is like, oh, this is who I am and this is set in stone. Absolutely not. We are constantly evolving and changing like every day. We're adapting to our environment. Our genes are changing every day based on, you know, the things that we're dealing with. So anyway, all of that sort of insatiable curiosity about the human world. And then also spending 20 years working with college students and young people who are in that that transitional moment of their life where they are becoming adults and they are learning how to live without someone telling them what to do all the time and helping guide them through that, through, you know, teaching classes on the biology of stress and things like, and realizing the things that they needed, not only just to learn the information, but to apply it to their life.
Yeah, definitely. And that sort of is an excellent segue to sort of my ulterior motive. So spoiler alert, part of the reason I invited Catherine on the podcast is because of her specific area of expertise and its intersection with the chapter, the new chapter in the second edition of Great Work, which is coming out on July 10th, is focused on collaboration. And what I wanted to just talk about with you in particular is I think of sort of the frame of that chapter is from my perspective and others that I've met like me who are sort of maybe self-described lone wolves, right? We just sort of end up wanting to do everything ourselves. We just want to, it'll be faster if I do it myself. I'll know if I made a mistake if I do it myself. Like, and over the course of the last maybe 10 years being more in business instead of being like a professor or a consultant the way that I was before, I've realized the limitations of trying to do it all myself. Like, it leads to burnout. Also, you don't get the benefits of collaboration. And I know that other lone wolves need the same kind of convincing that I did, that collaboration is not going to blow up and cause a lot of drama, but instead is well worth it. So I thought this conversation, maybe we could talk about like, why do we need other people for our mental health, for our stress? Like, how does collaboration work in terms of like, we are actually pack animals, humans, even though we sort of live in weirdly isolated ways. And so I thought we could just talk a little bit about that. So what comes to your mind just at the first, like your top line reaction to all that?
I have a bunch of reactions to that. Yeah. And so I want to start off, you know, and this is the nerdy biology side of me that says, you know, that wants to talk about the myth of the lone wolf, right? So, I'm with you. I all too often, I'm like, I can do it faster by myself. I can accomplish that. And high achievers like you and I, we have often been in groups where things would go smoother if we just take care of it ourselves. And that's true. And so it has a lot to do with who your pack is.
Yes.
But but of course the truth is that wolves don't live alone. And, you know, the only wolves that live alone are those that are outcast or problems. And they face a much higher mortality rate in the wild. And wolves are pack animals just like humans. And they thrive when they work together to hunt and raise their young and protect each other and all of that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Humans are not built to function alone. But we have this myth in our culture of like the lone genius, the lone success, like, and we want to be like them, you know, like Albert Einstein or Virginia Woolf or Michelangelo or like, you know, just these icons. And we remember the name. But what that idea of an isolated genius is that it ignores the countless mentors, collaborators, critics, and supporters that all come together that are part of a team that help that one individual like change the shape of whatever their great work is. And so it's incredibly important for us to recognize. And I do, you know, as a scientist, you're like, oh my gosh, I just wish I could be this one, you know, amazing person. And I forget, even though I see it all the time, like that person has a huge team of people that are helping them to do the thing. But that one person gets the glory, gets the name, puts their stamp on it. So anyway, I just want to like kind of like start out with a little geek out about that lone wolf myth and how much, you know, we do need to work to overcome it And it's okay that it's a constant struggle to sort of say like, no, no, I'm better by myself. And then to say, no, that's not always true. And how do we overcome that? So
that's so interesting. And Michelangelo, I feel like I recently went to Italy and saw the David. And so then when you're there, like, they really want to tell you all about the history, because Michelangelo went down, you know, because he would not have had the money to buy the marble if the Pope hadn't like commissioned that work. And he wouldn't have done the Sistine Chapel the way he did if Raphael wasn't two doors over, like copying his work and spying on him. So like both the challengers and the supporters, and then the Medici family taking him under his wing, like, and giving him an education. He wouldn't have even had an education or any access to any of those people if it wasn't for them. So I think that's such a great, like, even those people who we think of as like the Michelangelo, it's like, yeah, and also the Pope and also the Medicis and also poor Raphael, who gets kind of a bad rap for it. But that's, yeah, I think that's absolutely true. Like, it is a myth. I even think about, like, because I've been writing this chapter and I've been trying to like really get to the very bare bones of it. Even when you're in the lowest level, it's still, you're not, you can't do it on your own. You're using Monday, that some group of people over there, like, coded. You're using Canva, and all you're shaped by being in human society. Even if you are like doing your damnedest to be an island, you still aren't. But why, Catherine, why should we give up on this myth when, like you said, sometimes some of us have had the experience that every group we're in, we're driving it, we're, you know, which could be part of our problem. We might be kind of dominating, but, you know, like, how do we open up to the idea of doing more collaboration? And what can we look to in our own neurobiology that gives us kind of rock solid scientific proof that we really should?
One of the things I love about neuroscience is that we can approach this from several different elements. So I'm gonna think about this from a neurochemical standpoint at first. So we have hormones like oxytocin, which is the bonding hormone. Some people call it the love hormone, but it's really more social bonding rather than love. And it's released during positive social interactions. It deepens our trust and our cooperation. So that's it's a hormone that's released that helps promote our connection with each other. And it's linked also with some of the neurochemistry of our pleasure pathways. So neurotransmitters that people are familiar with, like dopamine and serotonin, they're part of the brain's reward system, and they reinforce positive behaviors. And those get released when we have positive social interactions. So it actually feels good to be social in certain ways, and, you know, at a very critical level. And so we have the positive side of it. There's also a negative side of it in terms of loneliness. So parts of our brain that feel pain, that experience pain, will actually, so for example, the anterior cingulate cortex will activate and process social isolation as physical pain. So when we are lonely, it's actually painful. And so there's a lot of pieces to this. The other piece that I want to throw in there, just because stress is one of the things that I talk about and research the most, is the reduced stress of being in a supportive group. That when we have social buffering from our stressors, that we can actually reduce the stress hormones that we have, like cortisol, for example. And that social experience will help us to regulate our emotions. Uh-huh. And I think this is a really important thing. Obviously, other people are often the source of a lot of our stresses, right? And communication and conflict resolution are some of the like key topics that I consult on and do workshops and things. But at the same time, the only thing that's going to get us out of our own head and stress moment is really going to be other people. It's going to be, you know, talking to someone else. And then all of a sudden you're like, yeah, that wasn't really that big a deal. Oh yeah, I can calm down from that. And it helps us to change our emotional response. So there's a lot of pieces here, from our behavior to brain regions, as well as hormones and neurochemicals, that all play a role in in the biology of why we need others and how we're inherently wired to need other people.
That's so interesting. And in schools, so when we teach this to teachers, the other thing I do is teach teachers and how to be teachers. We talk about the amygdala hijack idea, where when a student becomes just overwhelmingly aroused by their feelings of like, you know, like I'm not good enough, or I'm being rejected, or I'm being misunderstood, or whatever those sort of anti-belonging ideas are. Oxytocin is what we call it, I don't know, I think because of a book that we all read, the stand down. So it's like the amygdala stand down. So it's like the one sort of way you can bring your amygdala back, like out of the hijack and release the person into their cognitive state so that they can actually like use their cognitive resources to calm down and reframe in what you just said. And I think that's really, the way you said it was really important. Like when we get upset, we aren't that great by ourselves at returning to a state where we can not just survive, because we are surviving, right? Even if we're awash in cortisol with a heart attack around the corner, like we're alive. But to really thrive and actually get into a place of homeostasis, like we actually have to have other people to reframe it, people that we trust, people that can just connect with us.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And having those people, and that's where it means cultivating that wolf pack around you that is going to be supportive and help you to achieve your goals and help you to do things like co-regulate your anxiety. You know, if you know, you need someone in your life that has a calm presence and it soothes your anxiety, and they're the person that you can turn to when you need that. We need a whole group of people, because you have other people that are maybe like, yay, this is the person that always jazzes me up, but they're not necessarily the person that calms me down. Sometimes it's both, but we need a number of people in our life so that they can fill those different elements that we all need. In that emotional regulation process.
Yeah. So that's one great tip. It's like we need to cultivate the wolf pack. We need the people around us who can bring us back up, and the people who can calm us down, and the people who support us no matter what. And we also need the Raphaels who challenge us and push us to do more. So we need all those people in our lives if we're going to do great work, at least, right? If we really want to.
Yeah, I love your example there, you know, of Raphael pushing Michelangelo. We need that person, you know, that group that helps to increase our motivation and resilience. We achieve more when we're sort of challenged. We need challenge. We need to be pushed. We need to be motivated and to fall back on that resilience mode that we have so that it sort of helps us to push. And sometimes when we are part of a group or a team, either we're competitive with our, you know, in a productive way, and or that team, we sometimes fight harder for our team or our group than we might for ourselves individually.
Oh,
and
good point too.
Yeah. So it gives us a sense of purpose when we are part of a group and we have those social connections. When other people are excited for your success in your great work, like you don't want to let them down. And so even when you have those moments where like, I'm not motivated for myself, but you know what? I bet Amanda wants to see me succeed in this, and she's part of my team and I want to do this for her, you know, whatever that is. Yeah.
Right. And I think so there's two things I want to ask you about. One is like, I want to come back to the idea of other people being the source of our problems, because they're both the source and the solution. Like, let's return to that, because I think it is the nub that keeps most people sort of like in and out, in and out, in and out, like, you know, just not so sure about all of it. But I do want to say, like, I think that's such a good point that you made about how, like, when you do bring other people into your great work, so the levels of collaboration we talk about in the book are like solo collaboration, which is basically just you not collaborating, refusing and doing everything yourself and burning out. So not recommended. The one level up from that is delegation, which isn't super collaborative, but it like extends your capabilities, right? It's like
right.
Very important. Above that is like where people start to shape the work together, like co-creation of the work. And that's where I think you start getting into some of these benefits you're talking about, where it's like, I know that Catherine is waiting on this so she can do her amazing part of the project, and I don't want to let her down, and I don't want her to have come in on this project with me and taken such a risk on me and given me so much trust, and I don't want to lose that trust. And sometimes that, you're right, that is the thing that's like, whew, if I could just walk away from this and no one would ever know, I might, but Catherine now knows, so I better not. And like, that's so much about what brings great work to the forefront or not.
It is. And some of what you're talking about is this concept of like cognitive expansion. So collective intelligence of a group is where we feed off of each other, and it allows for more creative problem solving and mental flexibility. So we might, you know, for example, you and I in this podcast, we're bouncing ideas off of each other, and it's unlocking little neural pathways that I wasn't necessarily thinking of on my own. And if I sat down to write, you know, an essay or a chapter on collaboration, on the neuroscience of collaboration or something like that, I might not come up with everything. But when you ask a question or you pitch something, you know, oh, here's this idea or here's this example, now all of a sudden that unlocks a different part of my brain. And in a neuroscientific way, that what that is a neural network. So the way that our thoughts are in our brain is sort of in a little net of lots of different neurons that are all connected to each other. And so if you tap on one edge of that net or that web, it'll shake loose the whole rest of it. And so when we are working with each other, then we sort of shake out all these new ways of thinking about things that would be untapped if we were just in our own little rut back and forth.
Yeah, that's such a good way to put it, right? It's like you're tapping on all these unexpected nets. And then, I mean, isn't that how innovation happens? Where it's like you suddenly you're like, oh, but what about that bridge that we built? And you're like, holy crap, bridges and brains, and they're the same in this way. And here's this totally new idea. That's so, yeah. And I think that gets to the other levels too, right? It's one of the things that the chapter is called like the magic of collaboration, using the magic of community to unleash your great work. And it does feel like magic. Like when you actually bring somebody else in, you think that you're just having someone come in to help you do what you already know you're doing, but it's never the same project, much another person's involved. If they're really allowed to shape it, things do get better in unexpected ways because of this like net tapping thing that you're talking about. And then there's the level where it's like not just one person that you're barely letting in, like with your cold gripped hands, like trying to keep control over the whole thing. There's team of experts, which is like now you've got a whole team of people with all this expertise, which actually makes the impossible possible. Because then think of all the nets that can be tapped in a team of experts.
Yeah. Cause now you're tapping into so many more things. So many, you're unlocking so many more ideas. And I think it's amazing when you can do that. But I like what that you just brought up. That sense of control. And that's one of the hardest parts of working with others is that once you share ideas, then other people are going to take them and they have their own thought processes, their own life experiences, their own behaviors, their own ways of applying this information that you guys are sharing. And they might take it in a direction that isn't the direction that you expected. And that can feel uncomfortable. It can be challenging. And sometimes it can be exciting that they're innovating and unleashing. And, you know, but sometimes it can be really scary. And it's like, no, I can't control that. Therefore, it's gone in a direction I can't handle. Or, you know, and it can lead to conflict both internally and externally with that individual. So there's a lot. There, as you unravel and bring in more and more people, you know, when you're thinking about your great work, how do I launch that out and let go of control so that I can let other people be a part of it? And that's incredibly challenging.
Yeah. I think that is the prime, right? So how do you do that, Catherine? how do we do that? Like, I think that is like, really what I said we wanted to come back to anyways, which is like other people are both the biggest source of our stress and also the solution. So if that's the case, which it seems to be, like what skills do we need to have? Like what do we need to accept? Like how do we do this?
Well, obviously, if I could solve, you know, all social conflict resolution in, you know, the course of the next 5 minutes, I think I'd be a, you know, bajillionaire. But it does mean routinely working with people on conflict resolution and coming up with new ways of thinking about these things and dealing with, you know, like it's sort of like, you know, sort of meta here, like bring in an outside expert and on how to work together as a team and, you know, professional development and leadership and stuff. And that can happen in tiny little companies or, you know, like even in, for an individual to hire a coach to help them with some of that with their small team of people that they're networking with, right? So let me just say all of that. And then let me give a couple of examples of how to help the lone wolves of the world to ease into collaboration. So I would say first start with small positive interactions. So even really short, low stakes collaborations, like I love your steps of collaboration. But thinking about working through like the delegation and then the joining forces, like little baby steps there, little bit lower stake collaboration, what you can do is that you're activating mirror neurons and allowing those neurons in the brain to light up and to receive positive information from working with others and sharing information, sharing things. And that begins to make working with others feel safer. And so you're sort of stepping into that process.
Can you tell us what mirror neurons are? I feel like not everybody knows what those are.
Yes, absolutely. I can. I'm that you're right. I was I actually just made a couple of notes because I was like, oh, I should probably talk about what mirror neurons are. So it's a class of brain cells, and they play a huge role in human connection. And so they fire when an individual performs an action, and then when they observe someone else performing the same action. So that's how they were discovered in monkeys, is like these neurons. So for example, if I smile at you and you smile back at me, mirror neurons light up. We have mirrored each other and the neurons light up. And then what that's going to do is then trigger what I was talking about before, like reward pathways in the brain and so forth, the release of dopamine and serotonin, as well as oxytocin and so forth. So it's sort of the neurological basis for empathy, imitation, social learning, how we learn from each other. And so anytime we do things to mimic each other, then those mirror neurons will light up. And I'm so glad you brought this up, because this is one of the ways that you can actually do this with other people, is that you can use neuroscience to sort of manipulate people and grow your social connections.
Classic human behavior.
I know, right? The evil scientist moment. So when you are with someone and you see them do something, you can sort of subtly mimic their behaviors, right? So if you see someone who gestures with their hands a lot, maybe you start gesturing with your hands. If they make eye contact in a certain way, they smile a certain way, they have different patterns of speech and things like that, then you can actually begin to mirror those behaviors. And if you do it subtly enough, then what it does is actually builds trust with that individual.
Interesting.
Yeah. So that's a way of kind of using mirror neurons for collaboration. And when you have a whole team and you don't have to do it consciously, it'll happen unconsciously when you spend time with each other. But it's, you know, it's a, and what happens in a team is that when people are working together, the ideal moment is when they get into like a group flow and ideas are emerging seamlessly and the work feels effortless with each other. And their neural activity is like synchronized with each other. And so it's good.
And that sort of is tapping into what you said before, the collective or the cognitive expansion, the collective intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that it taps into, it's why mentorship and role modeling are so effective at social learning and skill development. So when we're working with others, we want to be able to connect with them through these different nonverbal cues as well as verbal cues. And then you get this collective intelligence that emerges because you're working together so much.
Mm-hmm. Because your mirror neurons are syncing you up?
Yeah.
Wow, that's so crazy.
I know. So cool.
That really explains some of the feeling of magic where you're like out of nowhere, you're not even communicating. Maybe like if you were to take a transcript and read what the people were saying, it's like not even clear what they're saying, but somehow everyone's on the same page. And out of that comes like a really unexpected, great idea that you could not have had on your own.
Yes.
That was what really pushed me. I was like, I don't like to work with other people. And then I found the right people and I was like, whoa, that was amazing. Totally different than when I just do it on my own. And that was like where I was like, okay, I better figure this out. And because it's not my natural state of being, it became a research project because that's just how I how I roll.
I can so relate with that. Yes, absolutely.
So that's great. So in a lot of the work that you do out in the world is, you're saying conflict management, sort of consulting and things like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So some of the things, before we leave mirror neurons, you know, I wanted to think, you know, just briefly, and this ties in with some of what I do. In the world that we operate in right now, there's a huge reliance on virtual communication, especially text-based stuff. And, you know, and this sort of loneliness, like the idea that people should be succeeding on their own and need limited interaction, and that spending time together is a waste of time, or spending time developing the relationship is somehow a waste of time. I just want to get straight to the point. And so that can lead to a lot of challenges in the workplace in terms of activating the mirror neurons. So what we want to do is to make sure that we're cultivating those relationships, like you just said, finding the right people, cultivating those relationships, and then the magic can happen. But we can't just skip to the end. It doesn't work that way.
That's such an important point. Because I think that when we talk about the sort of growing possibility as you bring more and more people in, is there's also growing risk, right? Like you said, like they could take your idea in a completely different direction. And if I have seen it happen where someone who was the leader of the idea, the person whose great work it was, and then the team came around it and it went in a direction that person really wasn't happy with and felt really betrayed and like probably had what you would downright call a traumatic experience trying to collaborate. So it is risky to bring other people in. And so you have to actually build the trust. Otherwise, it could go really sideways and all of our fears about collaboration are just reinforced.
Exactly. So when I work with others, whether I'm doing a workshop or individual coaching, then what we can think about are things like, how can we leverage what we know about neuroscience, like mirror neurons, for example, to improve those communication abilities. So thinking about like, okay, well, we know that people imitate each other. And you know, that can go in some really negative ways or some positive ways, right? You have the people at work who just spend their whole day complaining at each other. Well, what if you change that, you know, and as a leader or as, you know, a mentor to others, reframe that to positivity and really focus on what's going right and staying calm under pressure. And even if inside you're freaking out, that's not your role. Your role is to exude confidence. And then others will mimic that behavior and you'll get what you want out of others by setting those examples, for example. And then using face-to-face communication. So whenever, if you can replace an email or a text chat or something like that with a face-to-face call, I do a lot of things by Zoom. I love being in person. There's a ton that's added in person, but when possible, adding that as a FaceTime, you know, a face chat, like a Zoom or something, you get a lot of feedback from the nonverbal cues and you're able to activate mirror neurons in that way. And that's one of the challenges right now, because we watch videos, for example, like, you know, scroll social media, watch all these videos and the reward pathways might light up because you see people behaving. But we're not developing our own mirror neurons in response to that. So we can't. So it's actually changing the way people react and how they're interacting. So making sure to combine interaction with that is important. And the last one, I think probably the last tip I might give is really focusing on exuding positive emotions. And people sometimes forget to do that. And
they do. It's true. They're so caught up in their own worries that they don't, like, they forget that they're a role model or that they're creating the vibe around them.
Yes. You are, you're constantly creating the vibe. So when somebody asks, how you're doing, maybe don't lead off with the fact that you're super stressed, you're overwhelmed, everything's terrible, like, you know, the world's going to, you know, whatever, like falling apart. But start with, like, you know, a smile, a nod, open body language, trying to trigger the positive mirror neurons. And then as they share their concerns, you're maintaining that open body language and helping them to feel heard and valued. You know this as a professor and speaker, you know, like when, you know, you're in front of a big group, you're always looking at those head nodders and smilers and you're like, okay, that person is making me feel heard. I'm getting across.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah. But even when I'm working with an individual, I might recommend something like, if you're trying to give constructive feedback, use a compliment sandwich, lead off with something positive and then deliver that constructive criticism and then end with another positive note or something like that. Just that framing is going to help develop those relationships and collaboration.
Yeah. And build that trust. And I think there's also, like, it kind of comes back, circling back to you as the leader, right? Yes. When you are with your team or the people that you've brought together into your great work, like, it is your job to create a vibe where there's trust. And then you also need a group of people where if they're like, how are you? You can say, I am barely making it. So it's like, you don't always have to be the leader. Sometimes you need that group of people who can also show up and see you and hear you and say, like, dude, that sucks, but I'm here for you and we got this and you don't need to worry. And, like, sometimes you're that person for others, but it can be when you are in a position where you lead a lot of groups, you know, when you're always coaching or teaching or, you know, you're always at the front. If you don't have that squad, it can start to feel like, even though you're surrounded by people all day, creating trust everywhere you go, you feel really alone.
Oh, that's such a good point. It's really, really an important point. And when I talk to people who are executives, they're very lonely because they have to constantly be setting the example for others. And, you know, and if you talk to, like, you know, you were mentioning when you talk to teachers, or if I were to, you know, if I talk to clinicians, like healthcare clinicians and so forth, it's the same thing as what you just described. It's exactly it, that they have to set the tone and help others all day. And who's there to help them? And they need that extra support. It's absolutely important to have that person.
You're giving, 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 giving. Mm-hmm. No wonder you don't want to collaborate when you finally do something on your own, you know?
Right. Because you're so afraid that you're going to fall back into that same role.
Yeah.
Give some more.
Yeah. So that's just something, it kind of brings us fully full circle to that first point, which is, like, as a leader or whatever you want to call it, as the person bringing people together around a particular goal, your great work in this case, you have to think about your own resilience and your own stress management, because you cannot only be a role model all the time. And especially if you want to actually be able to have the resilience and the capability and the courage to really collaborate in a bigger way, then you need to even more so be taking care of yourself and making sure that you have the support that you need.
Yeah. Well said. Well said. Absolutely.
Well, I'm just saying what you said. So,
well, this has been a great collaboration, Amanda.
Yes, I know. We're such good collaborators. There's just trust flowing.
Yes.
But Catherine, I think people would be very interested in learning more. I know you are in the middle of writing your great book, but what if people want to get to know you before your book comes out? How can they learn about you, talk to you, connect with you? What's the path there?
Yep. Probably the easiest way. I mean, I have a distinctively spelled last name, Franson. So you can Google me, find me on LinkedIn. And then my website is www.fransonstrategies.com. And
we'll put it in the show notes. Yep.
Put that in the show notes. And then just shoot me an email and we can set up a quick chat or a Zoom. And I would love to talk to anybody about collaborative projects or helping out with whatever they've got going on. Yeah.
Well, that's great. Well, I want to thank you so much first of all, encourage everybody to do that because Catherine is lovely. She really is. She's probably a great addition to any team. And so encourage you to do that. And also then just thank you so much for your time. I know you're super busy. Catherine's writing her first book, and that means that she's very, very, very busy. On top of any other life, writing a book is like a full-time life all by itself. So thank you for taking the time for being on the podcast.
It's been an honor. I really appreciate talking with you.
Thanks for listening to Unleashing Your Great Work. If this episode sparked something for you, you'll love the Great Work audiobook, narrated by me, and now available on Audible. It's the perfect way to go deeper while you walk, drive, or just take a breath. Search Great Work by Amanda Crowell on Audible or grab the link from the show notes below. And if you're enjoying this show, follow it, rate it, and review it. It really helps more people find their great work.